Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is climate change affecting human lives right now? Although the future impact of rising global temperatures is a frequent topic of discussion in the media, experts working in the field are aware of a frightening litany of problems that can already be attributed to climate change, and many have a direct impact on human life and health. Dr. Paul R. Epstein is Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. His new book, written with Dan Ferber, is called Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
The point comes out loud and clear from the beginning of this book that global warming is not simply a future concern. Climate change is already hurting human health and in very significant ways. Why do you think that's something that ends up getting lost many times in the coverage of what climate change means?
Well, that's a good question as to why it gets lost, and maybe we can come back to that, because there's clearly a campaign of a drumbeat of doubt about the whole field of climate change, and that includes some of the health issues. I thought, listening to the news show today, it might be good to start with what is happening today with all of these extremes, because it's many of the extremes, heat waves, floods, and so on, that have implications for human health and infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
And just to sort of make the connections, the reason for all of the extremes, we really understand what's generating them. It's that since the 1950s, the ocean, the world ocean, has heated up 22 times as much as has the atmosphere in the continents. Let me say that again, because it's a big concept, but 95% of the global warming of the last half century is in the deep ocean. And deep ocean temperatures rising raises the surface temperatures, like we hear now in the Atlantic, 2 degrees more than normal, and that evaporates more. So that's what fuels the storms. Also, ice is melting at a very accelerating rate in the Arctic. So just to sum this up, water is warming, ice is melting, and then water vapor is rising because a warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor. 7% for each 1 degree C it warms up. So the whole water cycle has been transformed, and that means deeper, denser droughts in some areas, heavier rain and precipitation in others. And that's the real connection between global warming and climate change. Climate change meaning warming and altered weather patterns and sea level rise.
So we'll talk about those weather events and patterns in just a minute, but in and of itself, warmer waters in the ocean and elsewhere tend to harbor bacteria that can make people and also animals sick. Is that right?
This is true.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen incidences. Well, so infectious disease is one of the areas we're concerned about, and warming affects the potential range even of organisms in the ocean, while it's the extremes that affect the timing and the location and the intensity of the outbreaks. Here we've seen with water temperatures, higher temperatures leading to an outbreak of a diarrheal disease caused by eating oysters way up near Alaska by travelers, extending by 1,000 kilometers the previous range of this Vibrio parahemolyticus, something that's a relative of cholera. And this is happening in terms of malaria, dengue fever, West Nile, and so on land as well.
And then just a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was in somewhere in Southeast Asia, that people ate fish that had eaten some kind of toxic algae, and the human beings became very sick.
Right, and the toxic algae or red tides are something that are increasing globally. And nutrients add to this. There are three factors: the nutrients from sewage and deposition of coal, production of nitrates and coal fire plants. So there's the nutrition, then the warming of the waters, and then the extreme events like the floods that can just deposit the organisms, the chemicals, and the nutrients into water waves and trigger these harmful algal blooms. So they are increasing. They contain toxins that can be then taken up by shellfish and fish, some of them, and then hurt humans. We're seeing around the globe 350 so-called dead zones, which are hypoxic, low oxygen, or anoxic, no oxygen areas, all because of these proliferation of algal blooms, because, again, of the discharges as well as the warm water and the extreme events.
So let's talk about heat waves. You remind us in the book that they already kill more Americans than hurricanes every single year, and that, in fact, the deaths from extreme heat are very likely underreported.
Yes. Well, there are several characteristics of the heat waves that are occurring that help us understand why they're so lethal. First of all, they are increasing in terms of their frequency, their duration, their breadth, in terms of geographic extent, like the one in Russia last summer was far bigger than even the one in Europe in 2003, just in terms of land extent. But then there are two other issues. One is that since 1970, nighttime temperatures have gone up twice as fast as overall warming. That's true for winter as well. These are the so-called minimum daily and yearly temperatures. And then, as I mentioned, a warm atmosphere holds more water vapor, and so their higher heat indices follow because of the humidity and the temperature. So with climate change, we're actually seeing a change in the characteristics of heat waves, with little relief at night, and also higher heat indices. And this is what, in developing as well as developed countries, makes the heat waves that we're seeing today so devastating in terms of health consequences.
Yeah, and now in a place like Texas, and the audience here is largely in Texas, most of us have access to ways to cool our homes at night. Of course, this causes us to use a lot more energy. But there are many parts, not only of the developing world, but of the developed world, where people have never needed this technology before. And so they're really caught unprepared when it's, you know, no lower than 95 in the middle of the night.
Yes, you've said it well. I mean, the 2003 heat wave in Europe that we know affected so many in France, there's very little air conditioning there. It's not something they've prepared for. Russia as well, where this heat wave, both of them killed over 50,000 people, as well as crops and livestock and melting of water and affecting grain prices in Russia and so on. But the human health impact directly, yeah, they're not prepared for such heat waves. Now that becomes magnified when one thinks of Pakistan, which now regularly experiences temperatures of 50 degrees centigrade over the summer, some 120-something degrees Fahrenheit, and not only don't have electricity for air conditioning or air conditioning services, but also are having trouble with power itself. And so there's both ends of the equation in terms of preparing and withstanding that are missing in many developing countries.
And I'm guessing Pakistan is among those places that used to at least get very cool in the nighttime.
It was cooler. And India now, too, regularly experiences temperatures in the 120s during the summer. And all of this has changed over the last several decades. It's become certainly much more intense, more frequent, longer lasting, and affecting larger geographic areas.
So this year alone, just in this country, we've watched the devastation from powerful tornadoes in Alabama and Missouri, heavy flooding in other parts of the country. These obviously destroy property, in many cases injure and kill people. And then in the aftermath, talk about what happens when conditions on the ground are just really unsanitary.
Okay, well, in terms of the twisters and so on, that's a complex story to analyze. But the floods are clearly related to heavy rain events as well as now melting of snow that's formed in our last brutal winter that we've just recovered from. In terms of the effects, in a second, just to make the transition, what we're seeing over the U.S. is heavier, more intense downpours. Since 1970, the rain's gone up a little bit, 7%. But the 2 inches a day, 4 inches a day, 6 inches a day rains, half a foot a day rains, have gone up 14, 20, and 27%. So it's a whole shift to these heavier events. And after flooding, one sees fungi. That's a big problem for human health as well as even more so for agriculture. But one sees clusters of health problems, spreading of chemicals, new breeding sites for mosquitoes, spreading of waterborne disease. Over 2 inches a day rains are what gets the clean water supplies contaminated with sewage. And so that's the threshold for E. coli and cryptosporidium waterborne infections. So these really leave a whole plethora of health problems. And that's true in developing countries even more than developed, clearly.
And when you talk about the fact that overall rainfall has increased a relatively modest amount, but these amounts of rainfall are happening in huge amounts at one time. So on the other side of that rainfall, you have drought.
Well, that's true. And so some areas of the globe that have tend to drought are becoming more arid. And those areas that get rainfall are getting this more different timing and altered patterns and more intense rains. The U.S. is an area that where in many areas there are already water problems. We have aquifers that are overdrawn and underfed, and we're seeing a magnification of that water stress in the Southwest where you are, and California is threatened by this. Then it goes to the opposite extreme, clearly down the midstream, down the mighty Mississippi now flooding. So very little is in the normal, the old normal, and we're seeing these wide swings. And yes, drought is a big problem for the U.S. It was a problem for parts of Canada and affecting wheat. It's been, again, in Russia, which affected the wheat. Parts of Africa have been in persistent drought and recurrent and repeated drought, and it's devastating to health on a very personal level, as well as to agriculture and food and nutrition.
And in this country, when aquifers are low and river levels are low, it tends to be a political and a legal problem. But in other parts of the world, when water supplies are scarce, it can be a source of violence.
Well, that's very true. And there's some really deep analysis about the Horn of Africa, for instance, with the Nile, and which spans, I believe, seven nations there. And we have Sudan and Somalia and Ethiopia and up to Egypt and so on. Many nations are embroiled in political instability and problems. And some of the issues with water, who controls the water, who taps the water upstream, and who contaminates the water upstream. These are huge issues for that part of the world, and in many others, like in Pakistan and India and so on, with the Himalayas melt and rivers that they spawn.
My guest is Dr. Paul R. Epstein, Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Paul R. Epstein. He's Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. His new book, written with Dan Ferber, is called Changing Planet, Changing Health: How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. We invite you to join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. Paul, another consequence of extreme drought is the tendency for brush fires and forest fires to start. And besides the immediate impact, there's a whole series of consequences that these can bring with them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In terms of the drivers of that, drought is one. And the other that we've seen throughout the Southwest and up into Alaska is the bark beetle infestations.
Mm-hmm.
Here, just a moment, because we don't usually think of infectious disease in terms of trees, but the bark beetles are four things. They're overwintering, moving to higher altitudes, moving to higher latitudes, and even getting in more generations each year. So they leave dead stands, and the dead stands, in addition to the drought, contribute to the setting for wildfires. Clearly, wildfires are harmful to our atmosphere and can affect our health directly through emissions. Little appreciated is the carcinogens that come out of burning trees, or particularly the buildings and houses that get set ablaze. Then there's the effects on the watershed itself of the water coming out of such forests. There's the carbon sink that it's holding, and there's the oxygen that we lose from those forests, that so trees give us oxygen and take down carbon dioxide, and then clearly direct injury and death and so on. And so in general, we're seeing more fires, and the reasons are the heat and drought, as well as some of these harmful pests that are a problem not only in the West, but middle of the country has a problem with emerald ash borers, which is another beetle that gets the ash trees, the lovely ash trees from which we get Louisville sluggers and ladders and axe handles.
Hmm.
And we're looking at the longhorn, the Asian longhorn beetle here in the Northeast, and watching that carefully. That also will respond to warming winters, particularly, is what encourages their movement. So forests are in peril, and fires that affect human health directly and indirectly through water and carbon and so on, these are increasing problems for us, for Europeans, and elsewhere in the world.
Since you began your medical career in the 1970s, we have seen a startling rise in new diseases and reemergent diseases. Can you talk about some of the ones that concern you the most and how they are likely related to the changing climate?
Great question, because it's kind of a parallel trend. While climate is changing, this other trend has been sneaking up on us since the mid-70s, which is the emergence of new infectious diseases, the resurgence of old ones, and the redistribution of old diseases that's occurring on a global scale. And since the mid-70s, we're at about over 40 of these new diseases. Now, some of them are from our own practices, antibiotic resistance agents from using too many antibiotics in animals particularly. And then there are others like malaria and dengue fever that have been around for a long time. Those conditions are, the conditions for transmission are being changed. And then there are several new ones like the hantavirus pulmonary syndrome that broke out in the U.S. Southwest in 1993. And West Nile, which appeared in the U.S. for the first time, and its transmission was encouraged by, in that case, drought. So the hantavirus, just as an example, it's a rodent-borne virus. What we understand is that drought in 1992 and 3, a prolonged drought, decreased the predators of the mice, the coyotes, the snakes, the owls. And then there were heavy rains in the south, in the Four Corners area, particularly in February, giving new food for the rodents, pinion nuts, grasshoppers. So the mismatch of few predators and lots of new food led to a tenfold explosion of these mice and the release of a virus that may have been harbored there for decades. We don't really know. But the changes in the climate and the variability of it and the intensity set off through this ecological change in mice a new disease that then spread throughout the U.S. So that's one of the extreme examples. On the other hand, malaria is changing in mountains, particularly where glaciers are retreating, plant communities are moving upward, and temperatures are rising in the islands of Africa, in Asia, in South America. That's exactly where malaria is changing the altitude at which it can survive, and, for example, affecting Nairobi, a mile-high city, and way up in the mountains in Bolivia, and dengue fever in Vietnam. So this is a material issue, but clearly a sign because of what we see with the glaciers and the plant communities as well, that the ranges, potential ranges, are changing.
And your research has also found that dengue fever is poised to move into Texas at some point in the near future.
Well, it's barking at the door. It's in northern Mexico. It's barking at the doors of Argentina as well. So thinking both ways in terms of south and north, it has increased the area in which it can be transmitted. We've seen dengue fever in Buenos Aires, for instance, whereas it really hadn't gone south of Brazil before for, we don't know how long, but no recorded episodes. Now, there's a little bit in Texas. There are Aedes aegypti, the mosquito, but clearly people do have air conditioning. People stay indoors. People can isolate the breeding sites. We do have sprays and chemicals that help control the mosquito populations. But it's something that is a potential there. But I would say it's not the major issue for the U.S. We're looking at other things, other infectious diseases in the U.S., like Lyme disease, and still West Nile, which is into Canada and so on, that are much more potential problems for the residents of the U.S.
Well, let's talk for a minute about these mosquito-borne diseases. People might look back and say, well, in my childhood, we had mosquitoes everywhere, and we didn't have these diseases. But it's certain species, am I correct, of mosquitoes that will spread, that tend to spread certain diseases?
That's true, yeah. And it's not that there were not mosquitoes before in the southern U.S. and so on. We're seeing, clearly, clearing of swamps and wetlands and mosquito control programs of the Tennessee Valley Authority and so on, we saw a pushback of malaria carried by anopheline mosquitoes, dengue fever, and yellow fever carried by Aedes aegypti. So what we're seeing now is with warming, and particularly the warmer winters, we're seeing a resurgence of these diseases in many parts of the world where we don't have such good control, or threatening and requiring control in places where we do have means of control.
And then controlling, the infestation of mosquitoes is a challenging problem in and of itself, because you have to introduce toxins into an environment many times in order to get these populations to acceptable levels.
This is true. Although there are other ways, and for West Nile, for instance, West Nile is carried by mosquito Culex pipiens, it's called, in the West, Culex tarsalis. And these mosquitoes breed in a little bit of water that's organically rich. So they love catch basins and the drains and on the corners in urban settings. And we can use larvicides that are bacteria to put into the drains that kill the larvae of the mosquitoes, earlier stages, and obviate the need to spray large areas with Malathion or pyrethrin later in the summer when we get the threat of West Nile. So with an early warning system based on the conditions conducive to transmission, which in general is heat and drought in the springtime, we can introduce non-toxic, environmentally friendly ways and use that early warning system to protect public health.
Let's talk a little bit about greenhouse gases. We've seen rising incidence of problems like asthma and allergies. First of all, can elevated CO2 levels affect those symptoms in and of themselves?
Yes. This is an important dimension of this because just carbon dioxide, higher levels, we now know, increase the production of pollen in the fall from ragweed and the pollen from fast-growing trees in the spring. Allergies and asthma are basically spring. Spring is trees, summer is grasses, fall is weeds, primarily ragweed. And on both ends of the spectrum, just higher levels of carbon dioxide increase the growth of the plant by photosynthesis, but disproportionately increase the pollen, and they become more allergenic. So there's actually some other issues related to fossil fuels that exacerbate this. So put aside global warming for a moment. The pollen from CO2, particulates from burning fossil fuels help deliver the pollen deep inside our lungs. Ozone from other tailpipe emissions that actually goes up in heat waves can prime the allergic response. And then in general, we've seen an increase in the allergy and asthma season 2 to 4 weeks in the Northern Hemisphere, depending on the latitude and location, since 1970. So with the overall effect of the greenhouse gases, global warming, it's also extending this period. Now, one other example, poison ivy, it turns out, is getting stronger with higher CO2. The chemical within it, called urushiol, a strange name, but that's what causes the nasty contact dermatitis, that's getting stronger. So it turns out weeds and fast-growing plants really love this stuff, and they do better with that disturbance. And that's been a surprise to researchers, just hitting us really in the last decade.
Was there a sense initially, was there a theory that maybe our bodies were changing as opposed to the world around us changing?
that I'm not aware of. I think we're more adaptable, and I don't know really how we'd be changing other than clearly there are some thresholds and temperatures that we can withstand, and maybe they can change over time with some adaptation, but I don't think that's the major factor. I think it's mostly the world around us.
So you mentioned fossil fuels and particulates. Talk about the health effects we see from simply burning coal every year.
Good. Well, thank you, Chris. We actually just did a report about the life cycle costs of burning coal and mining it, transporting it, refining and cleaning it, as well as burning it, and then trying to do away with the problem by burying the carbon dioxide. And there are enormous public health issues going on in coal field regions, particularly in Appalachia, where mountaintop removal is really destroying the water quality for many parts of that beautiful, diverse area, as well as the dust affecting people's health and respiratory health. In the billions of dollars, if we calculate it out, then we transport it and refine it and generate sludge and slurry ponds. Then we take it to the coal combustion plants and burn it and get all the things that we know of, the mercury and the particulates and nitrates and sulfates, and that too has public health consequences. Clearly, the mercury, 48 tons of it per year from coal-fired plants, as well as the air pollution. So it's the whole spectrum. In our analysis, we found that there are hundreds of billions of dollars worth of these so-called externalities that really double to triple the cost of oil. Cost of electricity per kilowatt hour when burning coal. And it is a major contributor to our ill health from fossil fuels.
What will it take to ensure that those external costs get factored into, for one thing, what we pay for coal, and for another, our understanding of its overall cost?
Well, that's two questions, and I'm not quite sure it will ever get factored into the price, and I don't know whether that's quite the best way to deal with energy prices, because raising them tends to hurt the most needy and can be regressive.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly has to get introduced to our policy-making decisions. And here, understanding the true costs of coal and the impacts on our health, I think, has to be a major motivating factor in terms of getting us off fossil fuels and on to healthy solutions, some of which I'd be glad to talk about.
Yeah. What role does economic policy play in both the problems of climate change and the potential solutions?
Well, good. There's many dimensions of that question as well. And clearly, the economics on one end is that coal is considered a cheap source and these other sources are neglected. In terms of making the transition, we need economic stimuli. We need public sector investment that's leveraging private sector. I think even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce recently talked about the need for infrastructure supplied by the public sector, and there we're talking about ports and roads and bridges. Here, in terms of building the new energy economy, we need strong inputs from the federal government and local governments to lay the groundwork for the smart grid that could form the basis for an efficient and renewable energy-driven grid. Now, on a very much larger sense, internationally, economics are a major issue.
Let me jump in here, and we'll talk about that after our breaks, because we need to take a moment here. Dr. Paul R. Epstein is my guest. He's Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. His new book is called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Paul R. Epstein. His new book is called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. And Paul, just before the break, you introduced the topic of international economic response to some of these issues.
Sure. Because here what I've just described about state and federal funds, people may think, oh, my goodness, where is this fellow? We're having trouble with our budgets all over. And so here, and we do address this at the end of the book, we have to ask how we raise funds internationally without taking it from nations. And the fact that funds are necessary internationally to move the new technologies into the global marketplace. We learned this with the Montreal Protocol in 1987, which was the agreement to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals. Mm-hmm. And there it was stalled until there was a fund attached to it that allowed countries to make new chemicals. Here we are going to need a large amount of funds to buy, sell, transfer, manufacture clean energy technologies. And so what we're looking at is some of the areas that one could get this kind of funds. Finance itself, we know, has been on the loose for the last several decades and winding up with some real problems for us in the global economy. Turns out that actually every day there's a lot of hot money and speculation that's going on about currencies, about $4 trillion worth every trading day. So there's a proposal for a small levy on that, a financial transaction levy. Not our, it's been proposed by different nations, and some in Europe, some people here. A small amount could generate a large fund that could help this clean energy transformation, as well as for many of the other public health problems that we face globally. And so this could be a source of denationalizing funds. And while that sounds like the tail on the dog or whatever, it's really the driver. Mm-hmm. Because without the funds, without the funds to drive the trade and manufacture and transfer, all nations have not been part of the climate, causing the climate problem, but all can be part of the solutions given the right degree of funds dedicated to transfer of technologies. And this can be the boost to the global economy that is needed in this century. There really is no other driver that's sustainable.
You are adamant, by the way, that corn ethanol is not a good solution to our energy problems. Can you talk about why?
Sure. Well, there are several reasons. One is perhaps the most damaging is what's doing to food prices, along with demands for meat and extreme weather events and fuel prices. The displacement of crops for food with crops for fuel is one of the contributors to the rise in grain prices today, which is 75% greater than it was a year ago, wheat prices and so on. But it affects corn, wheat, soybeans, and so on. So that's a huge issue in terms of economics, in terms of public health, in terms of nutrition. Now, there's some others that are less well known. It turns out burning ethanol and gasoline mixtures produces aldehydes, like formaldehyde.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that stuff that we use to embalm we've used in the past. And that is one of the precursors to ground-level ozone. And there's three kinds of ozone. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's the good stuff in the stratosphere. The ugly stuff is its greenhouse gas on the ground. It's photochemical smog. So they've known about this in São Paulo in Brazil for years. Burning ethanol gasoline mixtures gives you more photochemical smog. That's bad for our health directly. In cities, it collects under a dome and contributes to the urban heat island effect that magnifies the impacts of heat waves. So there's the direct effects, direct public health impacts of burning corn ethanol or sugar ethanol, any ethanol, as well as the issues of land and nutrition and food prices and political stability.
Dr. Paul R. Epstein is my guest. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jacob on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question, statement, followed by a question, I should say. I had Lyme disease over 25 years ago. It was actually one of the first cases in Texas. And the way I remember it, diagnosing me with Lyme disease was far worse than the actual condition. They tested me for all kinds of stuff, and I actually got admitted to the hospital because of a fever and extreme pain. And there was a doctor doing his residency there from the Northeast up in Connecticut, and he just happened to have firsthand experience with Lyme's disease and tested me for it, and there we went. My question was, now that we know how prevalent these diseases are, how much of that can be attributed to just better networking and better information sharing through the medical community as opposed to just, you know, maybe there's dengue fever in northern Mexico, but like you said, maybe it's been there for 10, 20, 30 years, and we're just now finding out about it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Good.
For your call.
Well, I'm glad you got diagnosed, even though it was difficult, and treated, because it certainly can be a devastating disease. And it's the bacteria, it's not well known, is a little corkscrew called a spirochete. And spirochete, and as is known, that's what can give you symptoms and problems in your joint and your heart and so on. Where we see dramatic changes that we can't attribute to just over-reporting and so on is up in the Northeast. In the last decade, Lyme disease reports have gone up eightfold in New Hampshire, tenfold in Maine. They're in all 16 counties of Maine up into the Canadian border. And this is a direct result of warm winters. We see the movement up north as the winters warm because ticks have a two-year cycle, and that's what encourages them to survive. Just in terms of the U.S., looking at the whole picture, warming has occurred about 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last half century. In Maine, it's gone up 2 degrees. Winters have gone up 3 degrees. On the other side of the continent, in Alaska, winters have gone up 3 degrees. I'm sorry, the overall temperatures have gone up 3 degrees, and winters have gone up 6.4 degrees. A real whopping increase that affects the mosquitoes, stinging insects, the bark beetles, as well as the land and the tundra on which people live. So it's the lack of killing frost, the warming at night and winter, in this case winter, that really has led to a proliferation much faster than even our models projected, because they're based on average temperatures. So in Texas, clearly there are conditions are different and winters are not the same harshness, but in general we're seeing more ticks, more of there's other factors, the deer, the mice, and so on. So ecological issues, there's more deer, few predators of deer, so it's a combination of issues. But if we look at the larger picture, it's the warm winters that have really contributed to a significant increase in this nation of what's the most critical vector-borne disease that we experience in the U.S.
So we heard this week that Germany has made a resolution to phase out nuclear power generation within, I believe it's the next decade. As someone who's concerned with public health, where does nuclear power fit into either the problem or the solution as you see it?
Great. And we have a report on our website called Healthy Solutions for the low carbon economy. And we look at all the different avenues to all the different energy generating methodologies. If one looks at nuclear, looking at the life cycle, one has to think about security, safety, which we now know is a bigger problem than we realized a few months ago. And then storage, which we haven't solved. And Yucca Mountain is where the previous proposed site. There's 10 seismic faults actually running through Yucca Mountain, which is about 90 miles from Las Vegas now. I think it used to be 100, but Las Vegas has grown. Then there's the cost. They cost $10 to $12 billion to build, and they take 10 to 12 years to build. There are proposals for smaller units and so on, but all of them come with these very unsolvable, I would say, problems of ultimate storage. We now know that temporary storage is a big safety issue. And then one of the issues we talk little about is the security issue, and not just ramming planes into nuclear power plants, but these chemicals, radioactive chemicals, are carted on the roads, in trucks, in boats from Namibia, where they're mined, from Utah and so on, to our 104 nuclear power plants, and those are safety issues. Finally, there's water issues. At the 104 power plants we have, two-thirds of those are in places where the aquifers are now being threatened with, again, underfed, and drought and heat wave can magnify those problems. So there are direct issues facing us with a warmer and more extreme climate that are adding to the safety and security issues.
We have time to take one other call. This time we'll speak with Dwayne in Dallas. Hi, Dwayne.
Hey. I'd like to ask the caller about the I have no problems with the humans adding to the CO2, but in light of volcanoes, as we think of the volcano that just went off in Iceland, although humans produce a lot of CO2, it seems, and I've heard on other occasions, that the amount that humans produce is actually so extremely minuscule compared to what nature produces. I had heard at one time that if everyone had agreed to the Kyoto protocols and had abided by them, the first day of the Icelandic volcano that went off and caused such havoc in Europe, all that would have been reversed in one day. So I'm just curious, you know, although we do produce a lot of CO2, isn't it just absolutely minuscule compared to what nature produces? I can see ozone and all this other stuff.
Let me jump in. I appreciate your question, and I want to make sure we have time to get it answered. What do you know about that, Paul?
Sure. Well, two things. One is volcanoes, the major output is the sulfates that actually cool the atmosphere. There is some CO2 that comes with them, but it's dominated by particulates and sulfur compounds that are cooling factors. On a much larger scale, looking at your question, we understand the changes in the Earth's climate from ice cores that we study over billions of years. We have ice cores that go back 800,000 years that give a clear pattern of the orbital cycles that drive ice ages and the interglacials. All of what we see in terms of temperatures can be explained by those changes in the orbit and the tilt, as well as volcanic action, until we get to the 20th century. And then one can only understand the temperature rise in terms of the greenhouse gases. Now, it's not just what is produced. There are cycles, feedbacks, carbon dioxide is drawn down into the oceans and into the forests. What we're doing with fossil fuel burning is adding that on a certain amount, about a billion tons a year for each of us, and this is changing the whole balance. It's changing the amount that's absorbed, the amount that's in the oceans. It changes the amount that stays in the atmosphere, and it's the steady increase, not the one-shot deals of the effects of volcanoes that affect the long-term aggregate of how much carbon dioxide is built up in the atmosphere.
I'm afraid that takes us to the very end of the program. Dr. Paul R. Epstein is Associate Director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. His new book, written with Dan Ferber, is called Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Paul, thank you so much for making time for us this hour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Great pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.